Hello and welcome back to New Books in British Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Corey Gibson. I'm here today to talk to Dr. Nick Hubble, reader in English at Brunel University London, co-director of the Brunel Centre for Contemporary Writing. Dr. Hubble has written on mass observation and everyday life, on British modernism, on science fiction, on British fiction during the 1970s, 1990s and 2000s, on London and contemporary British fiction, on aging, narrative and identity. And he's currently working on a project on science fiction futures of modernism. However, in the proletarian answer to the modernist question, the book we're here to talk about today, which was published with Edinburgh University Press last year in 2017, Dr. Hubble seeks to recontextualize our understanding of literary modernism and proletarian literature and reveal interconnections and new emancipatory political horizons that connect those two literary movements. Hello, welcome to New Books in British Studies, part of the New Books Network, podcast network. I'm Corey Gibson, one of the hosts on New Books in British Studies, and joining us today is Dr. Nick Hubble, reader in English at Brunel University London and co-director of the Brunel Centre for Contemporary Writing. And we're here to talk about Dr. Hubble's book, The Proletarian Answer to the Modernist Question, out with Edinburgh University Press last year in 2017. So, Dr. Nick Hubble, a very warm welcome to New Books in British Studies.
Good morning to you, and thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
No worries at all. Very much looking forward to our conversation. So, I wondered if we might kick off with just a few words on who you are, Nick, and how you developed your particular interests in the field and how this book came to be.
That's an interesting question. I've been thinking about that actually more since I've written the book than before I was writing it. I mean, I come from originally the London Borough of Bromley, which is in the southeast of Greater London. So I was born there and grew up there. And one of the statistics I like to think about is in 1976, the year I started at my comprehensive school, Britain was, according to some metrics, the socially equal country in the world in terms of social mobility, the Gini coefficient, of things, even, you know, more equal than Sweden, according to some metrics. And of course, now it's one of the least equal countries, certainly in the West. And there's a kind of that political shift, and then I suppose also the way that kind of class figures in British life, to the extent that everybody is kind of in some degree aware of social class, I think still even in, or even more so perhaps in 2018 than in periods of the 1990s, when perhaps things look slightly different. But so that's the kind of factor coming into to what I'm doing. And I suppose I also grew up, the time I grew up, I think I was 16 when the royal wedding of Charles and Diana happened, and I went to a not the royal wedding gig in Bromley, kind of with punk bands and so on. So there's a kind of political edge. It's also the nuclear redeployment of the expansion of the deployment of nuclear weapons in Europe during the early 80s, I suppose, was a political kind of moment. And then the miners' strike, 1984 to 1985, which I suppose re-brought back a proletarian kind of conflict in Britain that was kind of reminiscent of the 1930s. And I suppose at that time I was reading things like George Orwell. I think that was probably the first writer from the 1930s that I really read seriously. But I also read Lawrence at that time, not Lady Chatterley's Lover immediately, but Sons and Lovers and other Lawrence novels. Mm-hmm. And I think that connection between what was happening then in the 80s and what was happening in these sort of novels of the 20s and the 30s came home to me. And I think later in the book, as we'll get onto, I kind of try and recapitulate that moment of how the reception history of proletarian literature alters in the kind of late 70s and 80s, as that, because those two periods seem to speak to each other. And I think that was something that stayed with me through a slightly you know, as I went through my life, and I did my degree in philosophy in my mid-20s, and then I moved on to writing a PhD in my 30s, mm-hmm. and the things I was interested in were, well, the PhD ended up being mainly about George Orwell and mass observation, but it was about the kind of late 30s period. But around that, I read a lot of things like Raymond Williams, but I also read novels of the period, kind of for contextual information. So I first read May Day at that time by John Summerfield. I first read Lewis Grassett Gibbons, Scott Square. I read Lewis Jones's the Welsh mining novels, Grimardi and We Live. So I read all of these books at that time, and it's, I suppose they fermented, and this was in the sort of late 90s, 2000s, and they fermented with me until I finally managed to get it all out there in 2017, last year, in the book.
Wonderful. That's a really compelling, like, autobiographical angle, which is, of course, again, an important part of the book. You do write quite often in there about autobiograph fiction. Is that the correct way to? Yes. Yeah. So one thing that occurs to me there, I know that you've also done a lot of work in contemporary fiction and in a new school of literature that was emerging in the 1990s and early 2000s, just when you were perhaps discovering, as you said, many of these texts for the first time. And perhaps when we get into the book in more detail, and especially towards some of those wonderful notes in the conclusion that really bring these discussions about modernism and proletarian literature in the interwar period into their own in terms of contemporary political discourse. When we get to that, perhaps we could talk about what connects and distinguishes the 30s, the 80s, and this contemporary moment in, you know, since the financial collapse in 2008.
Yes, I think, well, obviously that the 2008 context has added urgency to all these things. I mean, I think some of those trends, the kind of growing inequality, was already there before then, but that was the moment when I think, you know, the veil was shattered, if you like, and, you know, suddenly the start. In some ways, I suppose, like that 80s moment, another stark, resurgence of the kind of divisions in society, which I think are structured around class, but they're also, one of the things I'm trying to get at, they're also very much structured around gender, if you're looking at the 30s. And if you're looking today, I mean, obviously also ethnicity, and there's a whole range of, you know, intersectional ways we would look at things in, you know, current literary analysis that we weren't doing, you know, so much back in the 80s and 90s, and certainly not in the 30s. But I think we're gradually seeing strip bare all these kind of forms of interaction. And if you go back and look at these texts in the 30s, you can find them in those texts. That's the thing that I think kind of fascinated me. Actually, some of these communist writers from the 30s turn out to be more progressive than we think.
That's one of the great qualities of your book, I think, Nick, is that the urgency of those intersectional struggles, as they were in the early 20th century and as they are presently, comes through, and your discussion of the scholarly debates around modernism, around proletarian literature, like, inflect that. They don't stifle it, you know, which I think is one of the risks that a scholar runs in recounting the kind of scholarly discourse around things, you know, and risking a degree of, like, abstraction or something.
Yes, no, I think that is that is very much the case. I mean, in some ways, one of the immediate spurs, if you like, for me to actually get on and write this project into some sort of publishable shape, what actually came out of that kind of scholarly discourse, because I wrote a chapter for Kristen Blumel's 2009 collection Into Modernism, which came also an Edinburgh University Press book, and in that I was discussing particularly sort of William Empson and mass observation and issues around that. And in a review, Jesse Matz reviewed the book for Modernism and Modernity, and he actually noted in his review of my chapter, it sets up a provocative relationship between modernist and proletarian literatures. Our critical views persist in pretending at modernist ascendancy. Proletarian literature has its own claim to the sort of cultural transformation we associate with modernist ideology, but our categories reduce it to a more ordinary kind of realism. That's what he said in the review. So I thought, yes, that's exactly what I'm going to, that's exactly going to be the focus of the book. And I'm going to, you know, turn that around so that we do see proletarian literature as being exactly that kind of a modernist project, a cultural transformation. And what I was trying to do was not just to shoehorn, if you like, proletarian literature into modernism. I also wanted to shoehorn modernism into proletarian literature at the same time. I didn't want to submerge one within the other. I want to show, if you like, there's a kind of liberational impulse that's going across these works, and quite often to try and achieve, I think, similar ends. And that's kind of important to me. So it's kind of, you know, rethinking, as it were, the literary history of the period, rather than trying to just expand the canon a bit or tweak it.
It's such a testament to the truth that the scholars in our field have to believe. I think that literature is good to think with, that one of the most insightful and appropriate ways to tackle these very questions is to think of these characters and their interiority next to one another. You know, it's not a comparison that you directly make in the book, but I'm struck by imagining what, I don't know, Prufrock might have to say to Ewan Tavendale from towards the end of Scott's Queer trilogy. So, you know, someone who finds their agency in a mobilized collectivist kind of becoming history versus someone who is defined by their sort of flight from social relations.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a lovely way of thinking about it. And, you know, somebody needs one of these really excellent writers to do that kind of pastiche novel of the mashup of all these characters, perhaps. Yeah, no, I think that gets to the crux of it, and that actually, in some ways, that brings us back to that point of autobiographic fiction, which is actually a term from the beginning of the 20th century. I think it's from 1906 or 1909 or around about the time, but more recently it was resurrected by Max Saunders in his book, which is called Self-Impression, 2010. And he discusses it. I don't think the publisher would actually let him call the title of the book autobiographic fiction, because it's a term that perhaps didn't have the recognition, but I think it deserves that recognition, because in some senses, if you're talking about the importance of literature or the utility of literature, thinking through these kind of problems of self-awareness and how you deal with society and how you deal with different groups in society. I think the argument of autobiographic fiction is that this is how these writers did think through their relationships with society, and also kind of discover their own subjectivity, became agents within their own lives in some ways through this autobiographical process, whether you're talking about Virginia Woolf or whether you're talking about D.H. Lawrence or in other people that I don't particularly write about in the book, but, you know, Dorothy Richardson or Catherine Mansfield. And it's quite often the innovators were marginalized, either women or working class men or lower middle class or in some other way, you know, or exiles, or in some other way, kind of marginalized by the structure. And you can see it is a form of kind of cultural politics. But I think it's actually this imagining, this sort of, you know, constructing the self and working through, as Max Saunders says, not just the good things about you, but the kind of shameful things, in a sense, putting it all out there. I mean, one of the last ones sort of before the war to do this was George Orwell, of course. Although he did in fact come from a much less marginalised background, but there's still that kind of subjective kind of discovery by sort of letting your shirt hang out in public, as it were, metaphorically, and kind of putting all this down. And I think it was a kind of cultural project by which people you know, discovered things and discovered things collectively by reading and talking about it. And you can say it's a much wider democratic thing as well. If you look at the work of somebody like Christopher Hilliard, the cultural historians, to exercise our talents. You know, he discusses in their proletarian literature as part of a kind of wider process of the democratization of British society. It's basically self-reflective writing spread out. And mass observation is another area where that happened, the kind of thing that was set up basically by modernists, but encouraged people to write extensive diaries. And, you know, so this way of writing, if you like, spreads. So I think there's a huge, you know, if we're talking about the importance of literature in 2018, I think this is a period that would, you know, do well to kind of focus and promote, because you can sort of historically show the importance of literature, as, you know, in terms of kind of politics, subjectivity, and cultural democratization in that kind of period. So I think that's all, you know, that's a key way of a key thing that we should be doing in the discipline at the moment, anyway. So.
Absolutely. And there's, of course, whole generations, certainly in the UK, who you know, myself included, I was born in the mid-80s. There's a whole generation of people who don't have ready templates for thinking in collective terms about their political or cultural agency, right? It's been so long established as an individualized kind of discourse that returning to these literatures that belong to a period when these ideas were in the air can help us find a way through. Yeah, I wonder if, because we're really getting into the guts of the issue here, I wonder if we could pause and return just to the title. And I know it's maybe a cheeky question to ask you, Nick, but I wonder if you could explain what the modernist question is and what the proletarian answer is.
Ah, yes, well, that... The modernist question. This is actually, I'm taking this from Alec West, the literary critic, the communist kind of supporting literary critic in the late 1930s, in his book Crisis and Criticism, written in 1937. And he's discussing modernism. He says, you know, modernism, obviously that's the debate I'm talking about. C.S. Eliot, you know, primarily in the first place, is the kind of development of the time. But what it shows is the kind of one of the, you know, the fundamental question of our age. When I do not know any longer who are the we to whom I belong, I do not know any longer who I am either. So for him, modernism is about recovering that identity when, you know, the collective identity is not so obvious. And then he writes a whole, he says that Joyce has made a huge kind of, so that's the modernist question anyway. For him, Joyce has made a huge advance by talking about society as a whole, and that allowed him to be more kind of intersubjective, to relate the relationships between different classes. But Ulysses, which is what West was talking about primarily there, is not organized around, as we know, around the production process. You know, there's not too much work going on there. There's not the kind of factory kind of basis. It's a fascinating and absorbing a novel, but it and quite beguiling in that respect. But I mean, but what West was arguing is that work needs to be kind of in there as well. And then that's something I look at specifically in to some extent it's in Grey Granite, the final volume of Scott Square, but certainly in John Summerfield's May Day, which is set around a kind of factory. I think you can see that as, ironically, a book that was actually written, published a year before West's book. But, you know, he does it exactly that. It is like a kind of Joycean, Wolfian style and technique, but centered on the factory. So you get those. So in that sense, it is providing a proletarian answer to the modernist question, and it sort of shows who individual subjectivity is found through a kind of collective, which is not one, I don't know, solid mass just doing what the Communist Party tell them to do, our work. But it actually turns out to be an intriguing interset of relationships and that kind of expresses a kind of very nuanced and fluid sense of identity, which is, exactly why Somerfield was drawing on people like Wolfe and Joyce. He's using those techniques to show that identity, but also putting it within a kind of political and social context. So I think that is the proletarian answer to the modernist question in a nutshell.
I think it's a testament to the quality of your prose and the clarity of your argument that, when it boils down to an issue of course, a politics of solidarity requires some kind of conceptualization of intersubjectivity, that big buzzword of modernist technique that seems in retrospect, having read your book, blindingly obvious to me now all of a sudden. But I wonder if you could explain why these discourses have been so trenchantly separate since this period in the 1930s, and why an intervention like your book was required to bring these discussions back in touch with one another. This idea of modernism, of course, being a rarefied kind of high-minded bourgeois self-absorption, as opposed to the idea of a nakedly propagandistic proletarian literature, which draws from 19th century social realist modes, and so is outdated and can't keep up with the innovations of modernist technique. Why have those two positions become such a critical commonplace, do you think?
Well, that is a key question, isn't it? And I think what they happen very quickly. I mean, I recently, not so long ago, did some work on the 1950s, and I was very struck by reading at the time how vehemently the kind of, if you like, the public literary sphere rejects the notion of novels of commitment. There's things by Doris Lessing, I think, writing in about 1957, saying, "Oh, you just can't get up and say to talk and say, you're operating in the terms of commitment. Half the audience would just walk out immediately." And at the time, people thought the writing of the 50s was much better than the kind of joy camp writing of the 1930s, as I think it was kind of put at the time. I mean, which is a position that we look back now, and I think many people at the moment would be more interested in the writing of the 30s than the 50s. But at the time, there was a very solid change, and I think that the context of that are partly the Second World War, which in a way the proletariat kind of shut down in some way, I think, the proletarian subjectivity opening up, because both the actual war effort, which was such a significant strain on British society for 6 years, and the subsequent 1945 political settlement of the Attlee government and the establishment of the welfare state, I think it shifted the people could then look back on the 1930s and say, look, those problems have been fixed. We don't need to worry about those concerns at the time. I think you can see that in something like Walter Greenwood's Love on the Dole. That part of the key element of that book is the dissatisfaction of women with, if you like, working class culture at the time. I mean, Sally Hardcastle, who has this, who's in some ways the main protagonist of that novel, has this huge rant about how she's not respectable, she doesn't want to be respectable, she's not interested in these kind of constraints. And famously, she saves her kind of family from the dole by becoming the mistress of the local bookmaker. And I think a novel like that could be portrayed immediately after the war, even actually during the film version, which I think came out during the war. It could be shown, this was the dire straits people used to be in, the steps they had to go to. This won't be, we don't need this in the future. You'll be able to have respectable family life and for the welfare state. So that was one change. I think some of the politics of that period just got diminished by the welfare state. I mean, also the Communist Party literary kind of position shifted. It became much more social realist after the war although the actual change, the 1934 Soviet Congress, which advocated socialist realism, had been before. I mean, it took some time before that actually worked through into actual practice. And if you look at kind of communist writers writing and upper left wing writers in the late 30s, they're not really doing that. They're still influenced by the modernists, but by the time you get to the late 40s, that's kind of been either suppressed or people just not doing it. They're doing different things. I think those changes, and the Cold War is also another context, as we know. I think partly from the other direction, I suppose, in creating that idea of high modernism. We know that the for example, later in the kind of 50s and so on, the CIA were invested in supporting, you know, the privileging of kind of abstract art and whatnot, because it wasn't specifically concerned with political factors. So I think there's a range of things that happen that make that huge shift. So as you rightly say, so we stuck with, certainly going through the 50s to 60s into the 70s, there's a notion of the high modernists, Eliot and Pound and Joyce and Lewis, and then there's a notice of these proletarian writers, which are now no longer even read at that period, and they gradually come back in. And I suppose it's going to sound, I mean, I don't entirely buy into a sort of kind of I don't think anybody perhaps buys into a kind of vulgar Marxist economic determinism, but I mean, I think, you know, that I don't think the entire our world experience is entirely determined by purely materialist means in any way. But you can see that progression in history, because in the 70s, it's exactly after the point where the kind of oil crisis and, you know, the collapse of the of kind of exchange rates and the move towards the more kind of the beginnings of kind of neoliberalism and kind of financial crisis coming in that decade, that actually attention shifts back to looking at these proletarian writers, and people start writing about them again in the 1970s. Actually, quite often, again, the first people I think to really look at them in the mid 70s were kind of communist critics, you know, in journals like small circulation journals like Red Letters, connected to universities, kind of, you know, looking again at people like Lewis Jones and Walter Brierley and Love on the Dole and these other novels. And that's, and then Lawrence and Wishart kind of republished some of these novels at the end of the 70s, early 80s. And it's, I think it's purely because that political conjuncture had come back, and there's suddenly an appetite to look at these novels. So then, if you like, that they came back a bit in that period. So, but you're right, I think there was still a separation. On the one hand, you had the modernist kind of texts that were being treated, if you like, as a kind of high point of culture. And you had these proletarian texts alongside. And it's been since the kind of 1980s, it's been the sort of 28 years. 28 years since then, in which that shift has actually happened. So we get to the point where now you can discuss all these things together equally. And that, you know, that's quite a long, interesting kind of progression that's happened over that period as well.
And one of the, bring up a fascinating point there about the critical context into which these, your primary texts in this study either do or are not put into, sometimes depending on their fluctuations in popularity, their availability in print, their popularity, as you mentioned. But one of the striking things occurred to me just as you were talking about Love on the Dole a moment ago, is that, and this is something you discuss in some detail in the book, that several of these texts, to put it kind of crudely, appear on both sides of this argument, if that makes sense. Like Love on the Dole, as you said, the film version could be interpreted as oh my God, weren't things bad in the 1930s? We had to subvert traditional domestic gender roles in the working class home. But don't worry, we've sorted that out now. As opposed to your reading, and the more established popular sort of critical reading now that sees it as precisely opening up these intersectional struggles that you discuss in your book.
No, I mean, I think that is, I mean, obviously some of these books, there's competing, if you like, reception histories as well, you know, that you can find critics who've read books one way and you'll find then critics who are reading the books the other way. And that's that itself, I think, has been one of the reasons why that transition has taken so long, so that we can talk about these texts again as kind of intersubjective, intersectional, you know, liberatory texts that are kind of part of modernism. I don't know, that kind of, I suppose that reception battle. I mean, I try and get that into the book in the introduction, and that's one thing I wasn't entirely sure about how much people would necessarily want to read through a kind of chronological history of how that might have happened. But to me, it just seems a very fascinating subject, the way positions shift and how you actually shift out of the kind of, you know, what is the dominant paradigm, especially as you're operating, you know, if you're talking about really in an academic environment and you've got to contend with peer reviewers and colleagues and how people treat your work. I mean, and I had a feeling when I completed my PhD about George Orwell, Mass Observation, but not all the stuff I was interested in was going to get an audience at that time. Whereas I think what's really shifted from the modernist perspective has been the rise of the new modernist studies since the 1990s, where the kind of sort of jokey version of that is now everything is modernism, virtually from you know, including, you know, advertisements and, you know, popular radio shows and, you know, and what have you. But I mean, I think that's been immensely liberating academically, because it's allowed people to write seriously about all these cultural manifestations that make up the present in a way that wasn't possible if you had to stick to just writing about, you know, Ezra Pound or Virginia Woolf. Much as that, you know, much as I appreciate the value of that kind of writing, it's great to expand it out. And I think it's this is made possible in some ways, and plus the changes, as you said, right at the beginning, the 2008 shift, the political shift, and now we're suddenly in. I mean. And it's a commonplace thing to say, but who could have predicted the kind of configuration of politics in the West in 2018, even 5 years ago? I mean, possibly one or two, you know, people very, very attuned to that. But, you know, suddenly the world has reverted to these kind of dynamics. So that suddenly we have got a critical discourse, you know, very inclusive discourse around modernism. And we've got the kind of class conflicts and, if you like, the political conflicts and gender conflicts of the present, which actually tune back into what these 30s, 20s and 30s writers were writing about. So suddenly it all comes together. And this, you know, the moment, I think, has actually arisen. And that, you can see there have been a number of other more political takes on modernism actually published in 2017, books like titles like Red Modernism and so on. You can see there's a sense, I think there's a wider cultural sense that something shifted here. And that's the moment we're all trying to capture and work with and see where it goes.
It also expresses, again, this is something you put very, very lucidly in the book, that so many of the writers that we consider to be high modernists were given the sensitivity of their sort of political and cultural antennae, they were driven in their analysis to go one way or the other ideologically. And so the kind of discussions around the predilection towards fascism of our most treasured modernist writers is like well-trodden ground because of that. But I wonder if this is maybe a good moment then to turn to some of the particular texts that you go into some depth in the book. I know in the introduction and it comes back throughout, but also in the conclusion to your study, Naomi Mitchison features fairly prominently. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about her work and its reception and your use of it.
Mitchison's reception, I think, is on the rise, I think, in recent years. I don't know about the I think certainly think outside Scotland, I don't think she was a particularly studied, certainly in you know, until relatively recently, the last 5 to 10 years or so. And I think she fits in exactly in that kind of new modernist studies recuperation, which also includes recuperation of texts that once would have been described as middle brow. I'm not sure that Mitch is, I wouldn't describe Mitchison as a middle brow, right? I mean, that's one reason, you know, why I supported Christine Blumenau, you know, coining of that intermodernism term, because you needed some sort of term at the time to think about these writers who are using techniques, but, you know, also writing historical novels set in ancient Rome, which are autobiographies as well. And Mitchison, obviously, I think, is self-evidently, you know, wrote herself into her novels. It's typically, she was like a gay Roman man, a kind of priestess in ancient Greece, or these kind of structures. The reason I feature on We Have Been Warned, her 1935 novel in the Palatine article for the moment's question, is because it's fascinating, because she writes, it's so evidently Dione Gorton, so evidently her, is so evidently an autobiographic fiction. It's kind of structured in the current political context. There's a huge tour in the middle around the Soviet Union. There's discussion of her husband in the novel to Labour MP, as her husband would become in real life, and it's about the kind of politics. But there's also this huge section set in kind of Scotland, and there's also slightly fantasy elements of kind of witches, and plus an emphasis on gender politics and abortion and rape as well. I mean, it's got everything in it in a huge novel. Which got one of the best critical receptions of all time, was cut by the publisher, was not republished. It didn't get republished when her other novels were republished by Virago in the kind of 80s and 90s. She wanted them to republish it, but they wouldn't. It only eventually got republished in 2012 by Kennedy and Boyd in the Naomi Mitchison Library. And yet, if you look at it, it looks like a 21st century text. This is one of the clued me to that kind of comparison when I read it, because it has all the things that you would read in a 21st century kind of text. And, you know, nobody would have it, has any problem with, you know, mixing politics with fantasy elements, with kind of, you know, gender, which is, you know, in fact, it's incredibly ahead of its time. And I think she realized subsequently that she was ahead of her time, and kind of rode back from that. So for all those reasons, I think it's fascinating, but I think it's also because it is so self-aware of her relationship. And obviously Mitchison came from a well-to-do upper middle class, you know, quasi aristocratic almost family, with, you know, the daughter of an eminent scientist and a brother of JBS Haldane, also an eminent scientist, but also the kind of leading kind of Communist Party public intellect of the day. So and I think it shows exactly how I wanted to, in some ways, I ended up including my reading of that in my introduction to give the indication of what I'm talking about, how proletarian literature is not just literature written by members of the working class, which Mitchison obviously wasn't, and it's not. Also, I wanted to show that it's kind of dependent on that autobiographical kind of awareness and intersubjectivity. And I think that's what you get in that novel. Plus, you get the moment where she realizes she goes for a kind of her epiphanic moment, if you like, in that novel. The protagonist, Dione, is when she suddenly realizes that she is a Red. She hasn't said she's a Red before, but she's giving a lift to an unemployed driver, and unemployed man across Scotland. She's trying to explain her support for him, and he's pointing out the fact that she's driving this car, and obviously a lady. And then she says, "You know, I am a Red," and it's not a position that's come in the novel before. And I think that, I mean, I would almost certainly read that as a kind of, through writing that novel, also helped her, you know, to to rethink, conceptualize herself in actual life. I mean, she very much wears her heart and her thoughts on her sleeve. She's a number of these writers appear to who lets everything kind of hang out. If you read through the entire, you know, work of Mitchison, you can recover all of that. She also wrote this huge diary, million word diary for mass observation during the Second World War. So the, you know, there's masses of material to get there. So I like the fact that it in some ways I wanted to foreground that because it's kind of it's feminist. It indicates that this category of proletarian literature could be a much bigger, more expansive category than perhaps we're supposed to think of. And I think it showed how all those kind of politics came together at that period and are still kind of relevant today. I mean, especially the, you know, the relevant to kind of Scotland, post-referendum Scotland, in all sorts of ways. So that really was one reason I wanted to start with that. And because she talks specifically about factory workers, women factory workers in the Soviet Union in the novel, which is why the front cover of the book has got Soviet women workers on. Because when you're talking about the proletariat or the working class, you have to be careful, I think, about this the cliched image of it's not just a specific type of male worker, which is another thing I touch on in the book, which can be used as a kind of propaganda, not just by kind of Stalinist regime, but also fascist regime, or indeed the Conservative Party during the 1930s, or even currently. There's lots of talk about hardworking families, both in the US and Britain. That's a kind of unit that can be deployed for mythical and ideological purposes. So I wanted to try and show foreground how you can show that different representationally, so that it doesn't just become a unit in those kind of ideological positionings.
It really comes through in the book as well that formulation isn't akin to a kind of old-fashioned or unreconstructed notion of proletarian literature as social realism, as these characters simply having function in explaining the permutations of a particular ideology. The examples that you give are, of course, the argument you're making has to be substantiated with incredible intricacy and nuance, because that's precisely the basis of the argument as it seems to me. And so the prescience of Naomi Mitchison's novel, We've Been Warned, as you say, it really comes through in the way you write about it as well, the excitement of the sort of shock of recognition of so many kinds of intersectional issues that we're familiar with today but don't necessarily align with literature of that sort and from that period. So I wonder if we could, what follows in the first chapter of the book is the study of the Edwardian pastoral, and you use William Empson's idea of the pastoral to give some inflection as to how you're reading the idea of proletarian literature. The examples you go on to give in the book and these more sustained close reading of certain texts give so many different permutations of these, but that was an early formulation that you were drawn to. Am I right in saying that this idea of the pastoral mapping over the proletarian?
Yes. I mean, it's a key, that's an idea I've been thinking with ever since, struggling with, I suppose, working through since I first read Empson's chapter Proletarian Literature in Some Versions of Pastoral, which is his book of 1935. I mean, I read that when I was doing my PhD, and it I thought about it a lot in connection with mass observation at the time, but it's continued. I've thought about it in terms of proletarian literature, and I think partly because one of the points I wanted to get across in the book was the conception of proletarian literature in Britain certainly in the second half of the 1930s, was known as a literary phenomenon, and it was understood not as a particular fiction, as you said, reproducing a particular kind of socialist ideology, but more generally as fiction about the working class, involving the working class and class relations, not necessarily written by them. And certainly all the discussions you can read by critics in that period, people like Empson or George Orwell, you know, they're treating it as this bigger thing. They're not treating it as a narrow sort of ideological set of approved texts, if you like. So that was one reason why I very keen to feature Empson. And, you know, I suppose one reason partly why I've been engaging with this topic over the years, trying to think through that essay. Empson is a wonderfully ambiguous kind of rich and ambiguous thinker. You're easy to read, but thinking about the ramifications, you know, takes you a long time to work through them. And I like that kind of complexity. But I think also partly because it was Orwell who actually said, oh, I think proletarian literature began when Maddox Ford met D.H. Lawrence in, I don't know when it was, 1907, 1908, sometime around there. And Ford ends up publishing Lawrence's first stories in the English Review. And according to Ford, I mean, it's all like, oh, you know, he advised Lawrence to stick, you know, really feature the mining material because that was, you know, what made it distinctive. I mean, Max Ford is one of those factors. His memoirs and anecdotes always have to be treated with some slight pinch of salt because he deploys an autobiographical approach to his own autobiography. But that is why I think he was so responsive to different kinds of writers, because he was part of that kind of liberatory kind of project. And I think that moment of meeting of Lawrence with Ford, and actually there's much more that could be said about that than which I managed to get into that chapter, because I think you could, there's a lot of interesting political exchange going around in that sort of before the First World War, that gets occluded, you know, again was occluded by the focus on kind of high modernism in 1922, and that I mean, with Virginia Woolf's right in that sense. It really, you know, the changes happen in 1910, or, you know, at least that's a period you can look at. So I think that's one reason why I wanted to look at that. And I think these writers are, and such as Ford, Maddox Ford, H.G. Wells, in some ways you can see as a proletarian writer. He wasn't a member of the industrial working class, but he was the son of a domestic servant and a shopkeeper, originally coming from Bromley. So I always feel some affinity to Wells as well for that reason. But the fact that somebody from that background could become, you know, in many ways the biggest, most prominent writer in England in the early, certainly round about in the run-up to the First World War, is itself an amazing kind of shift. And I think that Wells often doesn't get the kind of credit that he's due. I mean, I think that, you know, there's works in production on Wells sort of coming forth in the literary arena that they're going to change our position on that. But even that was a huge shift. So, I mean, this kind of literary culture already with people like Ford, Wells, Lawrence is, in some way, setting the precursor for kind of proletarian literature. And it is, I think, with the kind of, as I've said, with the pastoral element. If you go forward into Lady Chatterley's Lover, which is where we go into the second chapter of the book, I think you can see Lawrence working out class relations in relation to the general strike. It's a kind of post-general strike novel. He went back to Eastwood just after, in the aftermath of the general strike, when the miners were still on strike, and that's very much it's very much a novel that's concerned with class relations, but it has, as we know, this very pastoral structure with the almost fairy tale structure with the lady and the gamekeeper in the kind of wood, and I think that's kind of part of the there's all sorts of ways you can think about it's a kind of a social criticism. It's about the wrongness of the time, but he's also trying to imagine a future where the two of them can live together. And that's kind of how I read the three drafts of that novel. He's working through the politics of it in a way that I don't think has always been brought out in Lawrence's criticism, but finding a way that these people can live together in a kind of more classless society. And you can even read, as I've tried to suggest, that there's a kind of more progressive gender politics to that that I think, again, is, you know, that is, I mean, Lawrence reception has been dogged in some ways by the kind of reading of him as a kind of institutionalized kind of sexism in some ways. And if you read some of the things where Lawrence is actually writing about the novel, I think, you know, that I wouldn't necessarily agree with him. But in that, that novel itself is written from the viewpoint of the female character. So when Mellor says something particularly of objectionable, you will get her snorting with laughter or, you know, rejecting it. You know, it's not, the things that Mellor say are not necessarily the position of that novel. And in fact, it's an interesting, it, you know, it's very interesting. The gender and the class politics combine, make it, again, it's a very intersectional text. I think we can read, you know, profitably in the 21st century. Again, you know, I mean, I'm going to end up saying all of these people were before their time. But I mean, like Mitchison, again, I think it's kind of ahead of its, it's very ahead of its time. And Lawrence also obviously understood himself as being, you know, misunderstood by his, and I think, you know, justifiably so in a number of respects. I think that it's those aspects, both of those writers, they're writing about class relations, in, I suppose, wider kind of condition of Britain or condition of England kind of context, which is coming out of Edwardian period, and it's kind of move, and it's, but at the same time, it's well, for example, so Lawrence was incredibly influential on the proletarian writers. I mean, the minor, if you read Walter Brierley, you know, even Walter Brierley's Sandwich Man, even the main characters describing Lawrence living in the streets, is going in a bus journey, and he goes, he drives past the street which Lawrence was born in. But Lawrence was also influential to all of those mining writers, because that was the model. You know, until that point, there weren't novels about, well, there weren't many novels anyway, put it that way. There's certainly not prominently known novels about the mining communities and working class miners. And suddenly, you know, they were there, and they couldn't be avoided. So for all sorts of reasons, I think that Lawrence is a kind of precursor and then contributor to the kind of proletarian literature trajectory.
Hmm. I think your discussion of the drafts Lawrence had to get through to find a way of articulating that kind of utopian possibility of a classless status, an environment where they could be together, really reminds me of something that comes up again and again in the proletarian answer to the modernist question. Is this idea of, and I might not be recalling the exact phrasing correctly, but you write often about one of these distinguishing features between an old-fashioned kind of unreconstructed idea of proletarian literature as being nakedly ideological or something, and the nuance and complexity of high modernism being this idea of delaying just the appropriate amount, the notion of the absolute, you know, not the political conundrum just immediately solved by some shrewd dialectician, but a kind of delaying and revealing just a flavor, just a hint of the possibility of restructuring gender relations or a classless society, what have you. I wonder if you could talk about that perhaps in relations to the subsequent chapters 3 and 4 on Lewis Gresset Gibbon's Grey Granite and John Summerfield's May Day.
Yes. Well, don't not bringing in the absolute too prematurely. I think that was it's William Emerson's joke about, you know, proletarian literature would be better aping the model of a pastoral because it doesn't bring in the absolute too prematurely. And I think that is that is what is happening in those novels. I mean, certainly, I mean, Scott Square and particularly Grey Granite, the third volume, I think it's probably the best example of that in some ways, because it's, although as we were talking about you and Tavendale earlier as the kind of the kind of proletarian subject, and his obviously a central feature in Grey Granite, but the novel is and the trilogy overall is kind of constructed around that final, if you like, oppositional it's not quite oppositional because there's a bit of give and take in the final meeting. But Ewan and his mother, Chris Guthrie, originally, and in the novel, but in some ways that's not. It makes the point that her surname doesn't matter, does it? Because it kind of changes throughout the novel, and it's that. Again, it is exactly that, you know, it's a novel, again, that falls foul of some of this reception history because it was repeatedly read as not being a good, if you like, proletarian literature in the old sense, because, you know, allegedly Gibbon doesn't really understand factories, possibly doesn't understand the working class, and, you know, he doesn't show male working class subjectivity as he should do. But I mean, the alternative reading of that is he is showing it and he's opening it up to criticism. You know, he's showing its shortcomings. I mean, there is a sense that Ewan will, you know, might work through this. Yet, I mean, he's not depicted as irretrievably kind of lost to some sort of Stalinist kind of position. It's a much more thoughtful balancing of the items. But I mean, there is, to me, it seems obvious, but a lot of that criticism just missed the point that the main protagonist, certainly of the trilogy as a whole, is, you know, a woman, and it's about her trajectory, and so therefore the kind of exactly those gendered critique and the kind of intersectional element to it is kind of in there throughout the way through. And again, I mean, he deploys some of these. I mean, it's set around the land. I mean, the feature of the novel is the land rather than the urban center. It has, at the beginning of Sunset Song, there's this kind of very weird sort of long historical, well, it's not that long, it's quite short, but a historical piece going back to sort of kind of, you know, monsters and things in the kind of, you know, medieval ages that comes forward. It's a kind of almost a folk version of kind of class history that's kind of employed in it. And I think it's the way he knits these frameworks together to show that there's a bigger perspective for looking at these issues than perhaps the primary concerns of the Communist Party, for example, in the early 1930s. He's trying to show a kind of wider perspective, and I think that's why it kind of opens that up so much. And again, the ending is the ending of Grey Granite is much discussed in the literature, whether, you know, Chris Guthrie dies or is not dead, or, you know, what this means. Is it a kind of defeatism, revolution defeatism, and so on. But I mean, I do read it, and I think other people have read it that way. There's a more kind of transformational shift. It's almost as though she's left our universe, which doesn't mean she's just dead in a materialist sense, but it's exactly that sense of the absolute, deferred absolute. There's a taste, there's a suggestion, if you like, of the absolute, but it's not, it's certainly not been brought in prematurely. And I think that kind of, I suppose there's also a moment that, obviously there's endless philosophical writing about the absolute, but I think it's exactly these texts show this relationship of, I suppose, this kind of going beyond, if you like, getting beyond, I suppose it's a kind of achieving a kind of subjective consciousness and agency that just puts you beyond the kind of constraints of the society you're in. And I think that you know, that could be seen as a kind of typically modernist impulse, that whether you're talking about something like Virginia Woolf, but it's kind of key also to these proletarian kind of text, because it's not just about, you know, improving the conditions of the working class, so then we need to stop worrying about these conditions, or, you know, getting out of the class and becoming middle class. It's an idea that there's some sort of wider kind of shifting consciousness available, and I think that's very clear in Mitchison and Gibbon. And, you know, we could have another conversation about how that how that feeds into modern Scottish consciousness. But I think it's also that's something that happens in these texts, a kind of transformational moment, which is not suggested. I mean, that's the kind of key thing. And I think in some ways the literature is a better exploration of that. I think it makes more sense to people if they're reading that text and identifying with that protagonist. I think that in some senses is the natural mode of dispersing those kind of ideas. So that's also, I suppose, something I'm trying to get across in the book.
It's interesting, that tension, you know, given how radical and kind of distant those emancipatory horizons at the end of the Scots Queer trilogy are. It's interesting that's that transcendence, that glimmer of the absolute, has to have gone through the sort of crucible of social struggles for emancipation that followed Chris through that trilogy. And I wonder if that's maybe that tension is will provide us with a good segue to John Summerfield's May Day.
Yes. No, I think it is the that was obviously the key issue, the social struggle, the relationship of the social struggle to the individual transcendence, which is not, I think it is also kind of intersubjective transcendence. I mean, as a final point I'm given, I mean, his use of the second person, you is a kind of a collective or, you know, at least an inclusive way of kind of expressing these ideas. And that does actually take us very, I mean, well, actually into Summerfield, because what Summerfield does is, I mean, May Day, for those who haven't read it, although it's 3 days, but it's unlike the one day of Mrs. Dalloway. It's kind of like Mrs. Dalloway, but set around a factory. So it uses some of the same devices. I mean, there's a bit of Dos Passos in there as well, but it uses some of the same devices, such as, you know, different groups of people seeing the same aeroplane, you know, to provide the kind of, obviously it's cinematic, both texts are cinematically influenced in that sense of the kind of cutting kind of possibility. And it structures this around the factory. So the struggle of the factory is kind of central. And the struggle actually in the text actually starts with the women workers in the factory, because a woman tail gets injured in the machine, and it's they who lead the deputation to the union, and the struggle builds out in that way. But interestingly, also the visions of the future in that novel, which are not so transcendental. So Summerfield is also another way of thinking about how this tradition feeds back into some aspects of what became the kind of post-war welfare state. But some of the view of the future that's given in that book is the woman Martine, who's the wife of one of the. It's a bit difficult to talk about central characters in May Day, because there's about over 100, I think, named characters, and we don't spend, you know, some of them feature a bit more, but the two brothers who are among the sort of half a dozen more prominent characters, one of them is John, I think, and Martine is his wife, and she, to be fair, is also one of the more prominently featured characters in the novel. And it's her kind of imagination, and she wants something to be a bit better, a nicer stuff. It's her kind of domestic imagination of a better future, which is also a kind of implicitly a more expansive, emancipated future as well, that kind of drives the novel kind of materialistly. I mean, Summerfield was a member of the party. He wrote this just before going off to fight in the Spanish Civil War. Subsequently, he wrote, for example, obvious propaganda novel, Trouble in Fourth Street, which I also discuss in the book, which is, you know, about organized version of organized rent strike. You know, so he was involved in the day-to-day political struggle, and this element is in the novel, kind of working relations. But it's also the extent to which it goes on the kind of consciousness, particularly of the women workers, and how they interact with the consciousness of other workers in the novel, and also into the family who own the factory. So you do get up into a kind of more Mrs. Dalloway-like moments. Even the cook, the cook is falling asleep thinking that tomorrow she's going to make, I can't remember what it is, she's going to make a cake or something. It's almost like a direct Mrs. Dalloway, kind of quite an affectionate pastiche almost of Wolf. So it puts all these elements together, and I think in interesting to make the point that it's a kind of shift, a collective shift of consciousness in London. It's the ending point of the novel is everyone is agreed on the need for a big change, but it's not because of the way he individualizes it. It's an autobiographical fiction of London in some way, with a kind of this intersubjective, intersectional element. It can't be reduced to that kind of propagandistic line. And there's a kind of sense that everybody could experience that kind of emancipatory moment, or that potential. And I think that's what it's about and why it works. Why it's such a, I think it's, in some ways it's a key proletarian answer to that one. This is one of the writers who's probably most engaged with modernist writers and writing something of that kind. I also think it captures that moment. It captures an actual historical moment where women workers were becoming more important. I mean, the 30s was actually the period where more women started working in industrial kind of occupations than as domestic servants. That shift, you know, which had been the primary employer, it was in the aftermath of the general strike, 1926, where, if you like, the male working class had been defeated, and also another context would be the 1928 equal franchise vote, where, you know, women got the vote at 21, which hadn't been the original position in 1918. So the franchise had been equal. That shift meant women were suddenly political agents. Unions were actually actively recruiting women. Somebody like the people like the Transport and General Workers Union. You know, there were women pages in the union publications. Women workers actually led the kind of agitation for the kind of holiday, paid holiday, at which actually came in sort of sometime in the period 1938 or something. So it actually captures a real moment of that kind of activity, which he relates to, I think, if you like, the emancipatory kind of awareness of modernism. And I think that's why it's an interesting book. It's a bit crude to say it's Virginia Woolf applied to proletarian literature, but in some ways you can see that inspiration motivating it. And I think it actually, in some ways, I think that carries on. Summerfield still has some, the logic of that has some purchase in the post-war kind of period. You can see it all the way, I think I actually suggest you can see it all going up the way the kind of working class women workers, for example, at the end of the 60s in the strike at Fort Dagenham, which actually led to the Equal Pay Act. You can see there's a direct line going back to the politics of the 30s that resulted in that kind of fundamental moment of equality. Which happened, you know, in the 1970s, and you know, you can see the film made in Dagenham, which in 2010, you can see it's a very late work of proletarian literature. In some ways, I think it's films that actually you may see stuff that looks directly like some of those texts of the 30s, things like Made in Dagenham and Pride, the film about the miners' strike, and other examples like that. You can still see that there's a kind of cultural continuity that comes through from these 30s texts in those that, you know, that doesn't necessarily come through elsewhere. So it becomes more complicated in that sense. And you can see how something like Summerfield can fit more into the post-war paradigm in a way that the other texts, mind you, not that Mayday was read in the post-war. It doesn't get republished.
It's
so it's not again into
this notion of the real material struggles and victories of emancipatory political agitation throughout the 20th century is a nice point to turn to your fifth and final chapter, because it begins, as you're saying, Summerfield's May Day is a kind of proletarian Mrs. Dalloway. Your fifth chapter begins with Virginia Woolf responding to criticisms, you know, that are fairly familiar to us of her being an elitist and her work being elitist. And that chapter is titled Outsider Observations. And I just wanted to let you know how much I love that formulation towards the end of the book, because precisely one of the problems you described is, in such thrilling detail, is this idea that, of course, the high modernists were allowed, are permitted to have been influenced by mass culture, by the culture and cultural and political implications of like enfranchisement and what have you, but proletarian writers were not, according to a sort of classic discourse, permitted to be influenced by high modernism, right? That it's like a one-way valve or something. So you're putting Woolf and a selection of other major writers on the outside of your discussion is a lovely inversion of that problem, I think. I wonder if you could talk a little about that final section.
Yes. I suppose in that session, what I'm trying to get at is come at, again, the kind of centrality of these concerns to modernism. And it's not just, I'm not just trying to, I mean, there was some discussion originally with the publisher whether the book should be called Proletarian Literature and Modernism, or this title, which I'd proposed originally, but fortunately speaking, I've been advised to stick with the title. So I stuck with it. But also, I didn't want the and relation. So I've devoted a certain amount of time in the book to trying to argue that proletarian literature is modernist, you know, in some sense, with Gibbon and Somerville and Mitchison as well. But I also wanted to, and, you know, also other people get, I discuss in less detail, but they're in there, like James Barth and so on. But also, I wanted to show that modernist literature is in some way proletarian, which is why I wanted to discuss Virginia Woolf again. I mean, I did discuss her a bit in the Edwardian chapter as well, I think. But I wanted to come back exactly to that, where she argues exactly that, you know, actually, you know, she's gone on this teaching for the WEA. She also didn't have, you know, X, Y, and Z advantages. I really like that. I like that defense that she makes. And also she talks about this, and then I go on to discuss her interaction with the Women's Cooperative Guild and the introductory letter she wrote to that sort of 1930 anthology of memoirs of members of the Women's Cooperative Guild. And it's kind of, she does do those, you know, she says, she sort of imagines getting the bath ready for the miner, you know, her mining husband. And it is a kind of exercise in proletarian literature. It actually comes very close, I think, in some ways to, I don't think that you can say there's a difference between her, although it's kind of metafictional. She's obviously doing it in an introduction. She's aware of what she's doing and she kind of discussing it and the problems of it. But I don't think it's so different to the way that some writers were actually writing. So, for example, Ethel Carney Holdsworth, a working-class writer, writing, I mean, her final book, This Slavery, starts the long period with the three women in a kitchen kind of talking, and it's a very, you know, they're having a very sophisticated, you know, wide-ranging kind of conversation. And I don't think there's anything really structurally different in what these kind of writers are doing. And that's what I was trying to show with Woolf, that, you know, it's not just that we can look at proletarian literature as modernist, we can also look at sort of modernist things as part of this kind of proletarian emancipatory kind of drive. I mean, why else is Woolf writing this introductory letter to these women's but I mean, she comes to the conclusion that, you know, the key thing is they had a room, the cooperative guild built them, they could meet and talk. So it kind of ties into her kind of room of her own argument. And then also goes on to free, I take this forward to Free Guineas, which again is a kind of, it's an emancipatory utopian vision. It's kind of grounded in different women's experience and the letters that Wolfe wrote, received from women writers, including working class women, who she then goes on to have an extended kind of correspondence with. So there is that. I just wanted to highlight that because I think it's different to the kind of cliched, stereotypical Virginia Woolf that we're given. And it shows those concerns. They stem from that autobiographical impulse. You know, if you want to write about yourself and really explore yourself, you have to explore kind of intersubjective relations and the intersectional relations. And that's not just with people, you know, in your own class, it's with, you know, also with, you know, all the masses when you're in the streets outside the cinema, or, you know, the servants or you know, workers or people that you end up kind of publishing with the Hogarth Press or whatever. I think she's in the same space as the kind of proletarian writers. And I wanted to show that she is part of that space, as is, you know, George Orwell and Mitchison, who again I've sort of come back to in that chapter. Mitchison actually wrote to Virginia Woolf after Free Guineas. Hers is one of the kind of Free Guineas letters, and I just think that's kind of that interesting kind of connection with two people who, although they wrote differently, are carrying out similar autobiographical projects, which actually align them with wider, beyond their own kind of class area to a wider kind of political project. And, you know, I'm trying to get that paradigm out there as much with the book as it's not just about reviving certain proletarian texts. It's definitely trying to make that argument as well, that actually
I think we've come full circle by connecting Mitchison to Woolf there. Yeah, there's the famous Woolf essay, Modern Fiction, of course, that describes the net of modern fiction not being freestanding, but being connected to social and material contexts, if you like, when you try to tug it free. I wonder if that's perhaps a nice note to end a discussion of the book on. I do want to return just briefly to this, some lovely moments in the conclusion to your book. You really do recontextualize lots of this discussion in light of contributions to contemporary political analysis and, you know, what readers, writers, students of literature, how they perhaps can apply the lessons of these texts to our contemporary context, just as the neoliberal consensus crumbles all around us. But I think we've taken up perhaps enough of your time. If you had any thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them. And then perhaps you might tell us what you're currently working on before we close up.
Partly with the contemporary thing. While I was writing, while I was finishing up writing the conclusion, actually Trump got elected, so that provides one kind of content. And I've just been at the Modernist Studies Association annual conference in Pasadena, and actually after the election, and obviously that put a kind of obviously a number of American academics obviously very concerned about that situation. Well, as you know, possibly everybody else as well. So that did give a certain heightened context, and I think it's, I mean, in some ways there, the discussion was, what is the history of, you know, where's modernism going? And I suppose one of the argument I wanted to make, well, I think modernism needs to move to look at, you know, being, focusing on this more political, intersectional, subjective kind of focus. I think the inclusive, expansionist, you know, period of the last 20 years has been great. But it's probably reaching the position where it's going to start splitting. And what we don't want to end up is splitting back to a more, refined, if you like, or high modernist or limited kind of vision of modernism. And I think, you know, it would be naive to imagine that there's not going to be some impulse in that direction happening, you know, that there's we're in a very kind of fluid political position, and there's a certain amount of counter-revolutionary acts, just going on in everyday life in politics, you know, around the world. So I don't think we should be surprised if we end up with something like a more, you know, a kind of active masculine version of kind of subjectivity, you know, being pushed for in some areas. So I was trying to suggest that we need to, you know, kind of organize and shift against that, which is, you know, one prime argument for looking again at these texts and, you know, rethinking that literary history. I mean, going forward, I've got a couple of projects. The one I'm just beginning, which is about called, I've just got a small research grant from the British Academy for a project called Understanding Social Change Through Autobiographical Narrative, where I'm going to be looking at material from the Burnett Archive of Working Class Autobiography, which is actually held at my university, Brunel University, but also mass observation. And that will be about how self-reflexivity of narratives fits in with kind of social change and how structures of feeling evolve and social values emerge and so on. But I want to tie that in as I get onward into a sense of autobiography fiction. So I want to expand the net just from autobiography. That's why I call it autobiographical narratives, give myself a bit of space. And to look at, you know, exactly the kind of text that I've been looking at in the proletarian answer to the this question. I suppose look at them more in a more rooted kind of political social context. There's a kind of more slightly more sociological dynamic to that project. That's where I want to go. But before that's fully underway, I'm finishing a book which in some ways is a kind of sequel to the proletarian answer to the modernist question, in a tangential direction. It's called The Science Fiction Futures of Modernism, from Virginia Woolf to 21st Century Feminist Speculative Fiction. And that is about, in some ways, the argument is, if modernism was the literature of intersubjectivity and social change in the early 20th century, it's now kind of speculative fiction of, you know, in some cases, quite overt fantasy or science fiction, or in our case, it's more kind of slipstreamy and speculative. But that is the 21st century equivalent, if you like, of modernism. So, and I'm kind of hanging that partly on Virginia Woolf's discussion of the Room of One's Own, you know, which she says in 100 years' time, we'll have a kind of women's fiction. And the actual example she gives, she comes up with this example of Life's Adventure by Mary Carmichael. She gives this example, which is actually kind of referring to these folks, I think, but it's a kind of Chloe and Olivia share a laboratory together, and then she imagines how, you know, this would be a literature in 100 years time. And what I want to do is try and bring that kind of political impulse from the proletarian arts to the modernist fiction, but trace it through a number of writers coming up to the present. People like Mitchison again will feature, but also Doris Lessing, but also sort of, you know, science fiction writers, Joanna Russ, Octavia Butler. How we get to a kind of 21st century thing where we have been warned by Naomi Mitchison, could have been a 21st century novel. Why we're in a situation now in the 21st century where that kind of range of themes of that is seen as kind of acceptable and mainstream and not some, you know, complete shock to the system that has to be centered and criticized. So it's that kind of shift I'm exploring. I mean, basically, Woolf's 100 years from 1929 or 1928 when she was writing, it was only 10 years off, you know. And in some ways, I think it's a very, you know, insightful book. I think those insightful idea, those changes that have happened, are happening as she's laying out. And it's a kind of continuation in some ways of the gender element of proletarian answer to the modernist question, just kind of sort of suggests that that is actually happening in literature. And, you know, that, I don't know, the political situation is not just a bad one. You know, there is a goal in insight, you know, one of the reasons there's a count, you know, you get counter-revolutionary movements is because there is actually a revolutionary impulse kind of ongoing. And I think we sometimes lose the picture of that in the kind of current political context.
That sounds like another fascinating and really timely intervention in the discipline, Nick. And perhaps perhaps when the time comes, you'll come back and talk to us about it.
I'd love to.
But I want to thank you very much for coming on New Books in British Studies. Corey Gibson, this is New Books in British Studies. I think that's about all we have time for at the minute. We're part of the New Books Network. And I've been speaking to Dr. Nick Hubbell about his book, The Proletarian Answer to the Modernist Question, out with Edinburgh University Press last year in 2017. Thank you very much, Nick. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye.